Now, I've kind of given you an introduction in the last session to the kind of worldview
that the people of the Old Testament had. Now, I need to emphasize that this is something that is not everybody had just one viewpoint. There was a wide range of views as to how all of these things interacted. And some people would be more influenced by one thing, and some people might hold much more strictly to a worship and honor of just one particular god, but they would generally accept that there were other gods, even though they themselves might only honor and worship one particular god. And so what happens is that people all the way around the ancient world understood the action of the spiritual realm in a manner that is generally very different than we do. Now, I use the example of war as an example of how the people related to their gods, but it was not just war, but it was basically every aspect of life. And so you have the success in the farming industry is a blessing from the gods, not just good farming techniques. People, when they were sick or injured and they were healed, it was a blessing from the god, not just that their body recovered from sickness. And in every aspect of life, the gods were seen as heavily involved in the people's lives. In fact, in most of the traditional religions, the way people understood their role with the gods was that the gods were these powerful beings, unseen, and in some not heavenly area, but just some supernatural area, and that the humans were simply slaves or even like chess pieces on a chessboard. And their whole life and death was lived out at the decision of the gods. And sometimes whether they lived or died depended on which particular god at that time had the most power and the most influence among all of these gods. This was how the people of that day saw life. And this was how they experienced life. It's very different than what we think of today. And so whenever we look at the Old Testament, we have to understand that we are seeing a very different experience with a god than the other peoples of the other nations had. And in some cases, the gods were generally considered very mean, very severe, and very harsh. This was the case with the Assyrian gods, the Babylonian gods, and this was the case with the peoples that lived in Syria and Canaan before the Israelites. And what was uniquely different about Egypt was that because Egypt had such a good, comfortable lifestyle because of the Nile, they always had food. They had sunshine almost every day of the year. They had what they regarded as a comfortable climate. They had success in war. They were unique, actually, among the ancient peoples in thinking of their gods as good. And instead of being mean and harsh and vindictive, their gods were actually generous and caring and beneficent toward them. And the Egyptian people saw this as the action of multiple gods in their land. And so when we talk about the God of the Old Testament, Israel's God, I want you to see at the very beginning that Israel's God was dramatically different from all of the other gods, and that the experience that the Israelites had with their God was dramatically different from the experience that all the other peoples had with their gods. And so as we go through this, it's worth mentioning this so that you realize, for the Israelites, when we talk about the names of God, it had a very, very important role to communicate different aspects of their God that were very different from the aspects and characteristics of the gods of actually all the other people. One of the things that occurs, particularly in the Semitic world, that is to say the world of the Israelites and the Canaanites and the Moabites and Ammonites and so on, is that when they referred to their gods, they oftentimes would use something like a nickname. And a lot of times a nickname is just a shortened form of a name, or it takes a particular characteristic of a person, and it becomes the reference by which that person is known. So in English, if a person is short, sometimes people will call that person Shorty. Or if a person is the son of a very well-known or influential individual, they might just simply refer to that person as son. There's various other ways. For instance, sometimes a person may be referred to as chief. Or boss. This is particularly common in certain cultures to simply refer to a leader or a superior as boss. And this is a nickname that is used. Sometimes it may have a good meaning, sometimes it may have a bad meaning. Sometimes it is just a word. We see this in the Old Testament, I'm sorry, in the New Testament, with a person named Paul. Do you know who Paul the Apostle was? Yeah, I figured you would. Okay. Paul was not actually, that was not his given name. His given name was Saul. And he came to be called Paul by the early Christians because in Latin the word was not Paul but Paulus, which meant short. And so the early Christians, when they would talk about Paul, they would actually be calling him what we today would say is Shorty. And he was apparently a pretty short man. And so when he would go to different places and people would talk about Paul, they were actually talking about Shorty. And he even adopted that for use for himself because you see in his letters to the churches, he does not say from Saul to the church at Rome or to the church at Corinth or whatever, but he says from Paul, or in the Latin, from Paulus, which is the equivalent in English of saying from Shorty. And everybody knew who Shorty was because that was the name that more or less was adopted for him in the early church. Well, in the Old Testament, there are a lot of names of God that have something of the same element to them. So what I want to do, and what is going to appear on the screen in a minute, I hope, are some of the many names of God that are found in the Old Testament. And each one of these emphasizes some aspect of God's nature and God's character. And none of these individually cover everything there is to say about God, but they emphasize some aspect of his character and his nature. Now, if you want, most of these are from the Hebrew, although Shaddai is not. But Elyon, Olam, Elohim, Yahweh, they are all Hebrew words. So if you want to learn these, then you can impress people with how much Hebrew you know. El, as I said earlier, is basically a general form of the word God, and probably emphasizes the ideas of a strong, powerful, mighty person, a ruler. In the non-biblical texts at Ebla, it also refers to El as the creator. And the term was one of the most commonly used terms among the patriarchs of Israel. That is to say, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You commonly find the word El used there. Before Moses, God was primarily known to the people of Israel as El. You do find some references in the earlier time to Yahweh, but most of the time you find El in some form or other being used prior to the time of Moses. And again, it emphasizes God is a strong, powerful, mighty being who is something like a ruler or creator of all that is. El Shaddai is actually, there's a song, El Shaddai, that you may know. And El Shaddai is probably something that evolved from the Babylonian word Shaddu. And it means the Most High. And so when you see in the Bible the use of the term El Shaddai, it's the Most High God, the one who is higher than all of the other gods. Since El refers to power and might, it is the God who is more powerful and more mighty than all of the other gods. Sometimes El Shaddai is associated with the highest mountain as a symbol of power and strength. And definitely among peoples in Israel and Syria and northern Iraq and in those areas, they were mountain dwellers. And so for them, the highest mountain represented the greatest power. And their temples were built not down low, but they would build their temples at the top of mountains. If you look at the temple of God that was built in Jerusalem, in the ancient city of Jerusalem, from David's and Solomon's day and earlier, the temple of God was built at the top of the mountain. It was called Mount Moriah. And it was built at the top of that mountain. And this was the concept that the greatest God was associated with the highest mountain. And so El Shaddai is essentially not only the greatest God or the most powerful God, but the one who controls all who fall in the shadow of the mountain. And in the morning, the shadow goes to the west. In the evening, the shadow goes to the east. So everybody who lives around that mountain are those who are controlled by that God. And this is the concept of El Shaddai. The fact that Abraham came from the region of modern-day Iraq, possibly Ur of the Chaldees was in the south, where eventually the city of Babylon would be built, or maybe there was another Ur that we know of now that was further to the north, closer to his homeland of Haran, and so he may have actually lived in northern Iraq instead of southern Iraq. But wherever it was that Abraham was from, he was, in one way or another, linked with the peoples of the Iraqi territory. And so the association with a Babylonian word meaning the highest mountain is thought to be fairly appropriate, since this is where Abraham came from. And El Shaddai is commonly more so found in the early chapters of the Bible rather than later on in the Bible. The second word up here is El Elyon. El Elyon means the highest God, the one who is at the top above all of the other gods. A little bit like the meaning of El Shaddai. But the difference is this. In the ancient world, even though people believed in multiple gods, there was one God who was higher than all the others. Actually, very often, the way that they understood this one God is that he was higher than all the others, and he was actually remote. He did not involve himself with the life of the people. So, if the sun shined, it was because the God that is responsible for the sun shining caused it to shine. If there was rain, it was because the God who was responsible for the rain caused it to rain. But above these gods was the highest God of those they honored and worshiped. And he was not actually involved in their life at all. He was simply there to be honored. And these lesser gods were the ones that actually were involved in the life of the people. The interesting thing is that you find in the Old Testament, in the time of Abraham, a king of the city of Salem, maybe ancient Jerusalem, you find the king of Salem as a priest of El Elyon, a priest of the Most High God. And so, whereas normally the people thought of El Elyon as not involved with the day-to-day living of their lives, here you have a priest at Salem who is the priest of the Most High God, El Elyon. And there is the idea that El Elyon is directly involved in the life of the people, because you have the priest who is there on their behalf. And of course, as king of Salem, he was also a priest of God Most High. So you see in the Old Testament, especially in the early books of the Old Testament, you see these kinds of images of multiple gods, polytheism, and the way in which these gods were organized one to another in the thought of the people. And so, for instance, with Melchizedek, you see Abraham, who is called by God to leave his homeland and come to the land that would later be called Israel. And you see him going to Salem, and you see him honoring El Elyon after his successful battle against the coalition of the five kings. And so you see that the God that he is honoring, El Elyon, in the understanding of the Old Testament, is the God who also called Abraham to leave Ur of the Chaldees, and later on would also be the God that would deliver the Israelites from Egypt, and would be the God whose temple would be established at the city of Jerusalem, where the Israelites would worship him. So, El Elyon was something that later on also would be used by the Israelites during the exile and after the exile as a term for God to emphasize that their God was the supreme God over all of the other people. So you find uses of El Elyon in the early chapters of the Old Testament, and then you find it used in different places elsewhere in the Old Testament as well, emphasizing that he is the Most High God, the most powerful God, the God who is above all other gods. Another name for God is El Olam. Again, a name that emphasizes a quality or characteristic of God. In this case, it refers to the fact that God is everlasting. We in our languages have the ability to express the concept of eternal or forever. But in the ancient languages, they did not have quite the same ability to directly express that. So for instance, in Greek, when Paul refers to the eternal God or everlasting or something like that, in Greek it actually says, under the ages of the ages. Because that is the most that the Greek language could ever express for the concept of eternity. In Hebrew, the word olam is similarly something that is today used to express eternity, but originally it would be kind of like the everlasting God. It was Abraham that we see this word used with whenever he planted a tree at Hebron, and it can refer to either the ancient past or the ongoing future. And so the idea El Olam conveys is the sense of long of days. In other words, lots of days or lots of years or years and years and years and years, or in essence, the ages of the ages, which is the equivalent Greek concept. It's a contrast to the pagan gods who usually went through an annual life-death cycle. And this was an important distinction of difference between the Israelite god and the other gods. So in the Israelite god, you have now. And the Israelite God existed in all of the ages past and would exist in all of the ages to come. Much later in the course, we will talk about the view of history and the worldview of the Old Testament. And one of the things that was dramatically different about the Old Testament worldview is that it saw human history going somewhere. And from the New Testament, we would say, yes, where it's going is to the eschaton, the return of Jesus, the thousand-year reign of Christ on the earth, the final judgment, an eternal future with God, and these things. But simply from the Israelite standpoint, in the Old Testament, history was going somewhere. It was not just what goes around comes around. But in the ancient world of the peoples around Israel, and this is so in Egypt as well as in Babylon and other places, they had the idea that essentially history was like this. It just went around. And so what happened was that their gods were associated with this entire concept. And so at a particular point in the year, you would have, in a sense, the birth or rebirth of their god, or their great god, or some particular important god in their world. And then later on through the year, there would be the death of that god. And then eventually you would come to another point in the year where you would have the rebirth of that god. And this was especially associated with agricultural communities, which most of the ancient world was. And so what would happen, and it's easy to see the association, during the spring of the year, you have the birth of the god, and you have the growing season and so forth like that. And then in the late fall of the year, you have the death of the god, followed by winter, in which the god is absent from the world, and the winter snows and the winter cold, and these things descend upon the people until the beginning of spring, and the god suddenly reappears. And this heavily influenced the idea of the ancient peoples concerning their gods and their way of understanding life. So that instead of seeing life as going somewhere, it was just the same thing year after year after year. And so El Olam is very important from the standpoint of the Old Testament understanding of God, because it is not presenting God as simply this life and death and rebirth cycle, but rather God is eternal and continuing and continuing and continuing and always there and always there. And so it gives a very different concept of the God of the Israelites from the gods of the other peoples around them, because the God of the Israelites was not subject to nature. Death is part of a natural occurrence and a natural life cycle. But the Israelite God was not subject to nature. The Israelite God did not die, but was always there. In the nations around, the God would die. You can go to this day, you can go to India, and you will find maybe it's not an annual death and rebirth concept, but you find the concept of reincarnation. And reincarnation is directly associated with some of their understanding of their gods. And so there is still, among certain peoples on the earth, this concept of a sort of cyclical nature to the spiritual realm as well as the physical realm. It may not be an annual thing now, but there is still something of this cyclical nature. But for the Israelites, their God did not die. Their God was everlasting. And this is where we have the idea of God being eternal from before the creation of the world until always in the future. And to understand that goes beyond our minds because we are influenced by the concept of time. One of the interesting things, I'm not quite ready to go to the word Yahweh yet, but one of the interesting things about the word Yahweh is that it roughly translates as I am that I am, or I will be who I will be. And Yahweh, in other words, is simply, in a sense, meaning I exist. I am here. And this is the fundamental meaning of the word Yahweh. As I say, we'll say a lot more about it soon. But this is the fundamental meaning of the word Yahweh. Now, a much more commonly used word is Elohim. And you find Elohim used frequently in the Old Testament. In fact, at least in the English translations of the Old Testament, every time you have the word God in the Old Testament, it is a translation from Elohim. Every time you have the word Lord in the Old Testament, it is a translation of Yahweh. And if you have Lord God, then you have Yahweh Elohim, which is the personal name of God and the title name of God. Elohim is the plural form of El. And this, of course, is something that some people have used to try and challenge the idea of there being just one God, or others have tried to use in some way either to challenge or to support the idea of the Trinity. But Elohim is the plural form of the word, and from the standpoint of the Jewish understanding of the word Elohim, the reason why it is used to refer to the one God is that God is, in their minds, too great to simply be referred to by the singular. And so instead, they intensify the word El by making it plural. And so it's kind of like God, the great God, the enormous God, the most powerful God, the everything God. And by making it plural, then what it does is it just simply enhances the quality and the character of this God. And so in Hebrew, this is referred to as the plural of majesty. God is too great to be referred to simply by the singular term El. And so in Hebrew, you see frequently the use of the word Elohim to refer to God. And as far as I can recall, you never actually find God in the Old Testament referred to as El. It is always Elohim which is the idea that God is too great to simply be referred to in the singular. There is, of course, from a Christian standpoint, an argument that can be made that Elohim actually is an acknowledgement, since you find it from the very beginning of the Old Testament, it is an acknowledgement that, in fact, the Trinity exists. But it's a difficult argument, both because that is not the concept that you find in Hebrew for the meaning of the word Elohim, and also because the word Elohim, since it is in the plural, would more quickly suggest, if not majesty, an intensification of the word, it would more quickly suggest three gods rather than the sense of the Trinity, three persons in one. And so the argument can be made, but I have to tell you that it's a somewhat difficult argument to support, to refer to Elohim as any sort of a basis for understanding the existence of the Trinity. Also, it is worth noting that Elohim is found in pre-Israelite usage among the Canaanites. The Canaanites used the same language that the Israelites did, which today we call it Hebrew. Other people might call it Canaanite as the language. But Elohim is also found in Canaanite texts apart from the Old Testament, meaning that there was a more generalized concept of the idea of Elohim as being this plural of majesty. And again, it would not be a very sound basis for trying to argue in support of the idea of the Trinity. Well, I think it's time for us to take a break. This is a good spot to break, because when we come back, we will start to look at the word Yahweh.